When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink, and I am here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. But first, a word or two about the economy, which is a topic we commonly refer to as Glinkonomics. So you may have noticed that mortgage interest rates were pushed down last week because of Friday's disappointing jobs report. In fact, only 126,000 jobs were added in March, and hiring slowed across the board. And this is the first time in months that we haven't seen a robust housing report. Not such good news if you're looking for a job. But if you're trying to buy a home, this isn't such bad news at all. In fact, it's pretty great news. That's because in response to the jobs report, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage fell to 3.66%, with an average of about a half a point in fees. It's just a little over 3.5%. The 15-year fixed-rate mortgage, and be sure to like hold on to your earbuds as you're listening to this, slid to 2.93%, and it has been below 3% for the past few weeks. These are incredible interest rate, folks. I mean, I don't even know any other way to say it. If you haven't refinanced, you have to get off your duff and go refinance. If you've got a 4, 5, or 6, or 7% loan, and I know there are people who listen to this out there who do have that, this is the time to get out and refinance. We keep hearing about how the Fed is thinking about raising interest rates sometime in July, okay? This is mid-April. July is not that far away. If you go out now or in the next couple of weeks, you're going to get one of these interest rates, provided you have good credit and some equity in your house. It's really important that you try. If you haven't heard my refinancing home run, like steps, 4 steps to a home run refinance, let me go over it quickly for you right now. Number one, you want to lower the interest rate. Number two, you want to lower your monthly payment. Number three, you want to shorten your loan term. That's where the big savings comes in. So if you can go from if you have 25 years left on your loan, you can go to a 15-year loan, amazing. If you've got 16 years left and you can go to a 10-year, amazing. Anytime you shave off years, you're saving really big bucks. And then the last thing, you got to manage the closing costs. And if you're paying a half a point or a 0.6%, that's pretty decent. Anything under 1% is a really good deal. So get out there, take advantage of these interest rates. I'm telling you, they will not be around here for much longer. All right, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I am so excited for the different guests that we're going to talk to. Our first guest is Svenja Gudell. She's the Senior Director of Economic Research at Zillow, and I invited her on the program today to talk about the real estate market trends that are putting a squeeze on middle-class and working-class Americans. We also have Dan Goldstein here with us today. He's a real estate reporter for MarketWatch, and he has 10 helpful tax tips for those of you who have waited until the very last minute, or if you've got an extension on your taxes. And by the way, anybody can get an extension. You just file a simple form. You do have to make your payment to the IRS and have it stamped April 15th. Peter Thomas Ricci works at Chicago Agent Magazine, and he's here to talk about the housing crunch for middle-class and millennial homebuyers. He looks at a little bit about what's going on in Chicago, but he runs down some of the stats nationwide. And our last guest is Marissa Calderon. She's the Deputy Executive Director at the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, and she's here to talk about the state of the Hispanic homeownership report and how Hispanics are really looking to buy more homes but are being held back because of credit issues, as so many other people are. All right, now that I've given you a heads up on who all of our guests are today, let's get started. Svenja Gudell is the Senior Director of Economic Research at Zillow. She's back with us today to talk about the trends she's seeing in the real estate market that are putting a squeeze on middle and working class Americans. Hey, Svenja, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
Sure. So you've just done another report about negative equity, which is where, obviously, negative equity is when your house is worth less than the mortgage you owe on it. Not such a good thing. The national negative equity rate you found is nearly 17%. How does that compare with what we've seen since, 2009?
You know, I think, so when we measure negative equity, we noticed that the height of negative equity was in the first quarter of 2012. And nationally, we were actually close to 32% at that point.
Wow.
So since that, we've fallen dramatically, now being roughly 17%. So good benefits or good progress on that front. But you still have way more than you should be having, because in a normal market, anything pre-bubble, negative equity really should be less than 5%.
Right. So negative equity, even as far as I recall, back in, say, the early 2000s or in the 1990s, I mean, negative equity, if it was over 2 or 2.5%,
right,
people would start to get very nervous. So we're at 17%. That's a significant issue. You found that in the fourth quarter of last year, 27% of bottom tier homes were negative equity, compared to 15% of middle tier, 9% of top tier. Can you give us some numbers so that we understand a little bit what we're looking at there?
Sure. And, you know, when we talk about tiers, it's really our way of looking at the market in thirds. So we take the entire housing stock and we divide it into lower end homes, which is the bottom third, the middle third, and then the higher end homes, which is the top third. And there you can really see that negative equity does not hit everyone in the same fashion, or not everyone is affected in the same way, meaning folks that are located in the bottom third of the housing market are really experiencing a double whammy right now. Not only are they more likely to be underwater if they own a home in the bottom end of the market, but they're also more likely to be very deeply underwater. So for those homeowners, it's going to really take quite some time to reach positive equity, and some of them will not reach positive equity unless they fully pay off their mortgage.
Wow, that's stunning. I mean, how could you possibly, well, it's got to happen slightly before you pay off your mortgage, wouldn't it? Or are the homes just worthless?
Sure, absolutely. At some point, you would break even, and you would have so little left on your mortgage that, yes, you would be in positive equity. But really, the trend we've been experiencing lately, where homeowners are being lifted out of negative equity simply by making their normal payments and a whole bunch of home value appreciation, that won't happen anymore. Home value appreciation by itself will not lift you out of negative equity.
Wow. Now, you found in the study that a quarter of all homes with a mortgage are underwater in some markets in Florida and in the Midwest. I assume in the Midwest, we've still got a huge issue in the state of Michigan.
Right.
But why don't you talk a little bit more about that? Because I feel like people are thinking that, you know, there were some horrible parts of Florida, but that the Florida had really come back.
You know, and that's true. Florida has come back a whole lot. It really depends on where in Florida. Even places like Detroit and Michigan are doing a lot better. Their negative equity rate has fallen a whole lot. Some of these places had 50% of homeowners with a mortgage underwater. So for them, being right around 25, 30% is a huge improvement, but it's still way more negative equity than we really should have. I mean, right where you're based in Chicago, you also have negative equity that's in the city of Chicago, upward of 30%. The metro of Chicago, right around 25% of homeowners with a mortgage that are underwater. So very, very high numbers. And to put a finer point on that, in Detroit, you actually have 50% of low-end homeowners being underwater. So one out of every other homeowner in the bottom end of the market is underwater. And in Chicago, that's almost 50%, right at 48%.
Those numbers are just stunning, and they make my head want to blow up. And I say that because in Detroit, they have been buying and destroying hundreds of homes. I mean, literally,
right,
just try and take out the very bottom of it, where they were selling those homes for $600, like, mm-hmm, for a whole house, a brick house, right? You know, during 2010, 2011, 2012, 13. I mean, they just can't get rid of those houses. And so now what they're trying to do is literally just take back huge swaths of them, level them, and get rid of them. And you still have 50% of homeowners who are underwater, which is terribly
right,
scary. Detroit is also having an issue with people not paying their water bills and their taxes, and those are causing other problems, and they're getting water shut off. But we'll save
right,
that for...
Right, a lot of service issues going on in Detroit right now. And I think a huge issue for Detroit also, is, as far as I heard, is that you have folks that are interested in buying homes, but they're not qualifying for mortgages right now because appraisers are not appraising high enough to actually meet the sales price.
Yeah.
And so they're not able to get mortgages.
Right. So you can't get mortgages and you can't actually sell these homes. And so you end up in a negative spiral, right? Because
right.
nothing is going to actually, you need something to pull things up, and the way it works with appraisals these days is not so good for
right.
this market. Okay. So Florida is doing better, but there are pockets of Florida that are not doing better. What are those pockets?
That is a great question. I do not have the detailed data on hand. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think it's probably at your website, and we'll provide a link to the study
okay.
as well.
That sounds great.
One of the findings that you had is that homebuyers buying in the fourth quarter of 2014 could expect to pay around 15% of their incomes towards a mortgage. Renters signing leases are paying more than 30% of their incomes towards rent. I assume that what you're trying to get at is that with mortgage interest rates falling again, and after last week's lousy jobs report
right.
from March, where you saw just 126,000 jobs created, mortgage interest rates started to fall. And I think I saw that the 15-year rate is now at 2.93% at Freddie Mac with about a half a point.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying it seems to me that buying is a much better deal than renting.
It really is. I think, you know, especially if you're, you know, right in the median there, right in the middle of the population, it's really a great time to buy that median home over renting it, just because renting is extremely expensive right now.
Yeah.
But of course, renters are facing a whole bunch of roadblocks to actually becoming homeowners right now, because even though the math might work out really well, you still have to come up with a down payment, you have to qualify for a mortgage, and you have to find a house right now. And there's very low inventory, in part brought on by these high negative equity rates. You're locking in a lot of homeowners, and that means all these homes that usually would be transacting in the marketplace aren't. So you have a lot of homeowners, especially on the bottom end, that aren't selling their homes. So first-time homebuyers aren't finding a whole lot of entry-level homes that they can actually buy right now.
I think it's a sign that really the market is still not normalizing. It's come a long way, certainly from where it was 2009 to 2012, even 2013. But I would say as far as normalizing, not so much. What do you think?
You know, I think, Elise, that's a great point. I think when people look at the housing recovery, they think, you know, the housing recovery is in full swing. And I think home values have certainly come back up. So in that respect, we're doing quite well for the housing recovery. But everything else isn't back to normal yet. And it will take quite some time to actually reach, you know, that normal state, or even perhaps a new normal, simply because all these other moving parts have to come up as well. We have to, you know, create jobs. Incomes have to actually rise. Incomes have really been rising on the top end of the spectrum. But at the bottom end of the spectrum, you know, if you're in the middle or the towards the lower end of income distribution, you aren't seeing much increases in your income right now. So other parts of the recovery really aren't quite there yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of normal, if you're thinking of what is negative equity going to be, I think we've reached a point where we aren't going to see a lot of decreases in negative equity anymore, and we'll have to live with a whole bunch of negative equity sticking around with us and us having to carry it forward in time now.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch for sure. Svenja, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Dan Goldstein is the real estate reporter for MarketWatch. He's back on the show today to talk about his 10 tips for tax season. And for those of you who waited until the very last minute or managed to get an extension to file your taxes this year, have we got news for you. Hey, Dan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. So as we're taping this, it is just a few, not even days, are left before taxes are due. I guess a few days are left. We want people to understand, if they're homeowners, what are the tax opportunities? So what have you got on your list of top 10 things that you can do to help your tax situation if you're a homeowner?
Well, Elise, I think pretty much everybody knows about the mortgage interest deduction, and that is the biggest one. Half of Americans take that every year, and it adds up to about a $65 billion return back to the taxpayer for what they might otherwise pay the government. And that's probably the most important one. And the only reason why the other half don't take it is because they bought the home too late in the year, and the mortgage deduction is just simply so small that the standard deduction is better. Or the other fact is that if you don't have a mortgage and you own your home, you don't really need to take it. But that's the biggest one.
But not everybody can actually take the mortgage interest deduction. I mean, there's about 70-75% of Americans who will not be eligible, either because, to your point, the mortgage is already paid off, or they don't actually have enough of a deduction to overcome the standard deduction they're allowed to take, or they make too much money, right?
Well, right. You can write off up to $1.1 million worth of debt. So you can actually write that up. Even a home equity loan up to $100,000 can qualify. And the key thing really here is that you really have to know what you can take. And the mortgage interest is just another one. But almost all the interest and all the costs you have to deal with when it comes to having a home loan is tax deductible. For example, let's take points. You can often write off the points. You may not be able to write them off, say, in 1 year, but you can write them off over the course of the loan, whether it's you have to amortize them or you take them all up front. But you can get it whether it's a discount point or it's prepaid. The way the IRS looks at that, it says that's prepaid interest and you can deduct it.
So we've got points on a home mortgage or refinancing. The points when you buy your house, deductible in the year of purchase. If you refinance, you can take it out over time. You've got the interest on a home improvement loan up to $100,000. You've got property taxes that are deductible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And property taxes are another one people do miss. You can probably take almost always take your property taxes. The one thing that I would advise people is that a lot of the things that you see on your HUD-1, on your settlement statement, that might look like taxes aren't necessarily tax deductible. That being said, if it looks like a tax and it sounds like a tax and it smells like a tax, you can probably write it off. I would just check with your advisor about that. You know, the only thing is, of course, is most of these settlement fees, though, are not tax deductible, like your attorney's fees, like your title fees, things like that. But if those are fees, they're not taxes. But right, there's plenty of other things that you can write off as well.
Now, we've got on your list of the top 10 things that you should know if you're a homeowner about taxes, you've got the energy efficiency tax credit and the renewable energy tax credit. I always like tax credits rather than deductions because it's a dollar for dollar reduction of the actual tax you pay versus a deduction, which kind of might be 20% of what you've actually paid. How many people are actually still eligible to take energy efficiency tax credits or renewable energy tax credits?
Well, the thing is right now, if you do these things such as install energy efficient windows, all these kind of things that help you save money and save energy. In fact, even if you put solar panels on your roof or even do a little generation windmill on top of your roof, you can actually write that. You can write a lot of that off and you can actually get a $500 credit for a lot of these energy efficient projects. And then for the bigger, more capital intensive stuff that we talked about, like a windmill, you can take up to 30% of the cost, which is very generous. The key thing is they are both going away in the next 2 years. So you have up until the end of December 2016 for both of them. So if you haven't done it this year, you can certainly take it in the next 2 years.
Right, you want to do it. Number six on your list, which I thought was a good one, is ground rent, or really it's a ground lease. There are, especially in manufactured home communities, the owner owns the land and you rent the land even though you own the house that it sits on, even if it's permanently affixed to the property. You see this a lot going on in England, Great Britain, where the Crown often will own the land and you've got a 99-year lease on it. And that ground rent, to your point, is deductible?
Absolutely. And, another place where we see that happening, there's certainly a lot of places in Baltimore, where I am in Baltimore County, that have ground rent. And another place that they have in the United States is Hawaii, where, just like you said, the royal family or the heirs of the royal family in Hawaii actually own quite a bit of land in Hawaii. So, like you said, just
really?
Like
do they
Britain,
still own
you
it?
Lease it?
I didn't realize
yes,
that
they
heirs still own it. That's great.
You've got to lease it. You've got to lease it from, maybe not from them, but from their heirs. So
somebody else. Okay.
That's right. That's right. But the IRS says that if you do pay that ground rent in either a monthly installment or annually, you can write that off. The only catch is that if you capitalize that ground rent so that you can get out from under it and you don't have to pay it again, that one-time payment is not tax deductible.
Now, I thought your number seven was interesting, and this I didn't quite understand how this might work. You've got the income and the interest paid on reverse mortgages. So the concept with reverse mortgages is that you don't pay anything until you actually sell the home. How does it work in terms of your taxes?
Well, the IRS looks at the reverse mortgage as a loan to yourself and not income. So that in itself is not it's not counted as income, but the interest that accrues as you take down that mortgage can be written off. Of course, as it says, you can't do it every year. It's only when you actually, you pay that off. So you can only take it one time, but you should be aware that if you actually do pay off that reverse mortgage, you can take the interest deduction that year.
That's sort of interesting. It would be really interesting to talk to a tax accountant about that, because typically reverse mortgages are sold when people move permanently from the house or they die and then they sell it. And that's how that reverse mortgage gets paid off. So it'd be really interesting to see that in practice. And if there's anybody out there who's actually done this, we have a bunch of tax preparers who follow us. If you've actually done that, please email me. I would love to know it at questions@thinklink.com. All right, quickly, number eight on your list is private mortgage insurance. Now, this was something that wasn't supposed to be deductible, but there was a rule that went into play that made it deductible, but I thought that rule came off. Is PMI still deductible?
Well, we've got one more year. If you haven't taken it in 2014, this is your last year to take it, because it goes away at the end of the year. So this is basically it for PMI. The good news is we've probably all seen that PMI rates are going down going forward. But when it comes to interest, taking off that interest, this is it. Taking off that deduction for PMI mortgage, this is the last year.
All right. And then you've got home expenses and improvements. What do you mean by that?
Well, obviously, you can't write off home improvements and expenses, but what you can do is add them to the cost basis of your home when you do sell it. So what that does is if you add that obviously onto the asking price or to the cost basis, you then narrow, obviously, your profits and your capital gains, and then you actually, hopefully, we'll have a smaller capital gains bill at the end of the year.
Let me be super clear, though, for anybody who's watching this. You know, you can't take painting expenses. Like, you're repainting your house, that's not going to count. We're talking about major structural capital improvements. You need a new roof, hot water here, you have to replumb the house. Those are the kinds of improvements that are actually going to be able to be added to the basis, not, oh, my daughter wanted a pink bedroom or a blue bedroom. That's not going to work.
That's right. And that's not going to do it. And I think right now, as we've gone back and seen, is if you can't pay Joe Contractor, you can't write off what you pay Joe Contractor for that. But the interest, if you get a loan to pay him, you can obviously use that interest, as a lot of people do. And it doesn't matter whether you use a home equity loan or a home equity line of credit, a HELOC. You can still take that interest up to $100,000.
And I just want to be really clear again. Just because you do the work doesn't mean you could write that off as part of the cost. That doesn't work that way. You actually have to hire somebody else to have that be as part of the expense. You do it yourself, but the IRS doesn't give you any bonus for that.
Absolutely, but the important thing is no matter what you do, document. You got to keep your receipts. You got to be able to show exactly what you did and how much it cost.
Right, which I think is a great point. And then finally, you've got first-time home buyers. I assume what you're talking about here when they're buying, it's writing off the points, but is there something else that they've got to think about?
Well, I mean, obviously, we've talked about the points, and the important thing is why the home interest, the home mortgage deduction is so important, because when you're that first time buyer, your first few months or your first few years are going to be interest payments only. So even if you can't take that mortgage deduction in that first year because you bought it in the, at the end of the calendar year, and as we talked about with the standard deduction, might be higher than if you took the mortgage deduction and itemized. you're probably going to be really well off if you can take that mortgage interest deduction the following year. So you can write off as much interest as you get for, you know, that first loan, and even if you have a second loan, like right. If you have a home equity loan, maybe you had an 80-20 split from back in the day.
Right. Let's hope not. Those didn't work out so well for a lot of people.
No, they didn't.
Dan, thank you so much for being with us. Dan Goldstein's the real estate reporter for MarketWatch, and we'll talk to you again soon for sure. The National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, otherwise known as NAREB, just released its fifth annual State of Hispanic Homeownership Report. And that's significant because the U.S. Census Bureau counted 320,000 new Hispanic households in 2014 alone. That accounted for 40% of all the new household formation in the U.S. last year. That's very significant. Marissa Calderon is the chief of staff at NAREP, and I invited her on the show today to talk about the expectations prospective Hispanic homeowners have. Sorry, let me say that again. Prospective Hispanic homeowners have about buying a home and the challenges that remain right now. Marissa, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks so much, Elise, for having me.
It's nice to have you here. So the number of net home ownership gains for Hispanics has actually slowed a little bit over the last 3 years. We saw an increase of about 347,000 in 2012, and then a much smaller increase last year of 54,000. What do you think is going on with that number?
Yeah, from our perspective and the research that we've done, there has been really a tightening of credit, and that has been really the primary barrier to home ownership for Hispanics. So certainly the appetite is there on the part of the consumers, and the current credit conditions in the market are what has prevented access by more home buyers.
So the home ownership rate has dropped for Hispanics from 46% or a little over 46% in 2013 to 45, a little under 45.5% last year. But the net growth of owner households was positive, and formations are growing faster. But are more people renting because they can't buy? Is that what you think?
We conducted a survey of the top 100 Latino real estate agents in the country, and 60% of them indicated that they had noticed a tightening of credit in 2014, and that seemed to be the primary barrier to more of those households becoming owner households as opposed to renter households.
So what is it that's changing for credit? How is it that Hispanics are not able to take advantage of what I actually think is an easing of the credit market?
Well, many of the conditions that Hispanic borrowers face are different than other borrowers. So you have issues of being unbanked or underbanked, or from an income perspective, there are a lot of entrepreneurs within the population. And those conditions make it more difficult within how things are scored today, especially considering the use of FICO nearly as an exclusive credit scoring model in terms of being able to make sure that those individuals are scored and are properly assessed for risk.
I find that there is a number of companies that are trying to get into this alternative credit space. One of them that I work with is called eCredible, which is, you know, working on ways to get big-time lenders to use alternative forms of credit in order to make sure that people are credit-worthy. They're finding that there's more of an interest in alternative credit than there ever has been. From your point of view, are you seeing lenders be more open to the possibility of using other kinds of credit, maybe how people are paying cell phone bills, or how they're paying their utility bills, other kinds of utility bills, or even rent payments? All of these are now under consideration. What is NAREP doing on your side to sort of push lenders?
Well, there certainly does seem to be an increased appetite to understand how those factors can affect scoring and risk assessment. And from a policy perspective, NAREP actually has a policy position this year to really encourage the use of alternative credit scoring models, whether it's the one that you described or VantageScore or others, as a means of properly assessing risk for borrowers and to open up the credit box a little bit more where the borrower is creditworthy.
I want to say that everything changed with the housing crisis starting in 2008. FICO credit scores were supposed to be this predictor, this great predictor of risk. And they, in my view, they completely failed in that people lost their jobs and suddenly everybody, nobody could afford to pay their mortgages, something that was not predicted at all in a FICO score. It's basically a snapshot, right? The day that, you know, you've got your credit. This seems to be another way to do a better predictor because, you know, if you're losing your job, yes, you're going to have trouble making your utility payments and your rent payments and all the rest. So it seems as though those two things are equal. From your perspective, what else are you suggesting would be a good way to assess risk?
We feel like there should be, you know, a little bit better understanding of how to calculate income and different kinds of income, whether you have a W-2 employee or you have additional other streams of income. So that would help to better understand the borrower's risk.
Does NAREP recommend going back to no-doc loans, you know, where you could just state your income?
Yeah, not at all. We just suggest that that there be really an overall whole house evaluation in terms of how to assess risk on the part of the borrower so that all of the factors are considered as opposed to just one single element.
Do you find that there's people are lenders, regulators, Washington, D.C., is everybody kind of getting on board here that there needs to be a better, more holistic model for this assessment of risk?
Certainly with Secretary Castro's recent announcement, there does seem to be a little bit of an increased appetite in Washington, D.C. and amongst regulators to just have a better understanding of how to assess risk. So right. We're encouraged by that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if it actually is going to work a little bit. Now, Hispanics are just growing, and we know that they're growing in number, they're growing in economic boost. They're lowering their poverty rate compared to annual income. Where are you seeing the power, the purchasing power of Hispanics?
So, well, currently the purchasing power of Hispanics is at about $1.5 trillion. That's roughly equivalent to that of Canada.
That's amazing.
And we see that, yeah, definitely, really breathtaking.
Breathtaking.
And we see that increasing to about $2 trillion by 2020.
So what percentage of the economy do you think that will be at that point?
It'll have increased significantly for the U.S. economy. And for Hispanics as a whole, they tend to have sort of interesting purchasing patterns when it comes to electronics and smartphones and certainly early adoption of internet and of different forms of social media. So that tends to influence how that purchasing power is utilized within the economy as well.
You know, it's interesting. The last time I took a look at this, that immigrants were within 3 years, immigrants who came to this country and said, I want to buy a house, within 3 years they were able to make that happen. And it certainly seems as though Hispanics continue to follow in that path, that home ownership is a good thing. They want their piece of the American dream. And it seems amazing to me that the ability to actually go and make these things happen, the power that immigrants have, it's truly one of the wonderful things about this country. And it's been great to see that as a group, Hispanics continue to grow and put so much into this economy.
Yeah, that we echo those sentiments as well. And while I will say that our research shows that immigrants have certainly helped to fuel a lot of housing growth in the country, with the waning of a lot of immigration into the country, Hispanics continue to still be a driving force for homeownership. So, you know, irrespective of the influx of immigrants, Hispanics that are here in the country already continue to want to be homeowners.
Have you looked at all into the purchasing powers of the Latin American homeowners? I know that they're in places like Miami and in New York, Texas. You're seeing a tremendous amount of dollars come in from people who live outside of the U.S. but who are Hispanic. Have you guys looked at that as well?
We focus really nearly entirely on U.S.-based influences. So if you've already immigrated to the U.S., then we have data and research on that. But we tend to feel like our plate is relatively full with the U.S.-based work.
I can imagine. I can imagine so. Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Marissa, for being with us today. Marissa Calderon is the Chief of Staff for the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest today has been reporting on the challenges facing home buyers here in Chicago, my hometown, even in what seems to be a very historically affordable housing market. Peter Thomas Ricci is the assistant editor at Chicago Agent Magazine, and he's been reporting on the housing crunch for the middle class and for millennial home buyers in Chicago. And I thought he should come on the show today to talk a little bit about those trends so that I can then compare them with him to some of the stuff that we see going on nationwide. Peter, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you for having me.
So according to Trulia, Chicago is the second most affordable large metro area in the nation behind Atlanta, with 67% of housing stock affordable to the middle class. We just were talking in the past week with Zillow, which says, that, I think it was Zillow, that says that Chicago still has almost 48% of homes with mortgages underwater. So that's another sign that, you know, especially at the lower end, affordability is pretty high here, and people are pretty much still underwater. We haven't seen the market come back enough. Tell me what you're seeing and the reporting that you've been doing.
Well, it's a very interesting situation that we find ourselves in because, like you were just mentioning, Chicago has many more housing opportunities than you typically see in other large metro areas, especially compared to, say, a San Francisco or a New York or a Los Angeles. Its median home price compared to incomes and the qualifying incomes then that come along with it are very accessible compared to those other higher priced metro areas. At the same time, though, there are many lingering effects from the downturn. You mentioned negative equity and how it remains among the highest in the nation here in Chicago in lower price points. And you also have different economic issues that we also have to confront. And that's what much of my reporting the last couple of months has dealt with. For instance, and these are more national numbers, but they very much relate to what we're seeing on the local sphere. One eye-opening stat is that 34% of Americans do not have any savings of any kind. That was a recent NeighborWorks study.
Yes, it's absolutely true.
Yeah. And on top of that, 47% of American adults only have savings that can last for 3 months. Now, again, those are eye-opening stats, and it's easy to think, oh, well, that's just one study. But then you have other studies from other equally reputable sources that are very eerily similar to that. So, for instance, the Federal Reserve did a study last summer, and they found that 48% of U.S. adults could not cover a $400 emergency savings without selling or borrowing. And just the other week, Fannie Mae released its latest national housing survey, and they found that 52% of Americans have not seen their incomes improve at all in the last 12 months. So, of course, someone could be listening to these stats and thinking, how does this relate to the housing market?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you are facing day-to-day pressures of that sort, you don't have savings or you have just enough savings to get through either the next rental payment or the next mortgage payment, it's very unlikely that you'll have the necessary equity either to qualify for a mortgage or even make a down payment. So even when we see, for instance, Fannie Mae announcing it'll guarantee mortgages of as low as 3% with a down payment, that still represents more money than quite a few Americans can afford.
So in Chicago, what you're saying is basically, you know, a smaller percentage of people are actually able to afford a house here in Chicago, where we haven't actually even seen the rise of home values much as we've seen them in every other part of the country, and that there's a trend towards just less affordability. I mean, if people, and I say this all the time, you know, a really strong jobs market is the thing that equals a really strong housing market. In the Chicago area, in other Rust Belt communities, we've not seen sort of a resurgence of the job market at a price level in terms of what people are earning to be able to afford ever-increasing home values. I think, is that what you're getting at?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And looking at it from a bigger picture, this is a very interesting housing market, historically speaking, because normally when you look at past economic downturns, it's always been the housing market that has led the economy out of recession and into recovery. But as everybody knows, the housing market was at the center of this economic downturn. So the reverse is true for this recovery, where housing is now very much dependent on wider economic trends towards reaching a true recovery. And because that recovery, though, has been unequally distributed, mm-hmm. and you have large swaths of the population, as I just cited, who have not really participated in that recovery,
yep.
that makes buying a house then even more challenging. And there was an amazing statistic that came out from Realty Track last week. They compared the rate at which home prices have risen in metro areas to the rate at which wages have increased in those metro areas.
Yep.
And here in Chicago, prices have risen at 7 times the rate of wages. So to build on what you were just saying, this is a remarkable time to buy a house. Interest rates are still at historic lows. Home prices, especially here in Chicago, are still beneath their historic averages. And you have all the other obvious benefits that come with buying a house: a static mortgage payment with a fixed rate mortgage, equity that you can build in the house, there, and the,
are
of
you,
course, the
have,
tax
has your,
reductions.
Let me jump in and just say, has your reporting shown any particular neighborhoods that you think are better bets for investors?
Let's see. Well, many neighborhoods on the north side have seen substantial increases.
They have. And
yes,
I think they're a lot less affordable. You know, traditionally, historically in Chicago, the South and the West parts of the city have been the most affordable. But by the same token, they're the ones that have the least number of, you know, extra goodies in the neighborhood. They're the ones that typically don't appreciate as fast. But are there any mm-hmm. pockets that you've seen that may offer a special benefit to investors?
Well, I think the next emerging area is certainly going to be the Bronzeville near Southside, mm-hmm. because the South Loop has been exploding
yep.
in value for the last 5 years or so. In fact, if you look at appreciation, with the exception of near North Gold Coast and the West Loop, I think the South Loop has seen some of the most aggressive price appreciation
yep.
of the recovery. So we can very much expect to see that development move south. But again, to reiterate the main point here, we're going to have to keep an eye on how these larger economic trends affect housing, and especially what happens as Gen X and baby boomer buyers start to move out of the housing market and millennials are expected to move in, because there's a whole host of economic challenges that millennials face that the previous generations did not have to grapple with.
And we'll cover those in future episodes for sure. Peter Thomas Ricci is the assistant editor of Chicago Age Magazine. Hey, thanks, Peter, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I want to just say a big thank you to all of our guests. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinkglink.com. That's thinkglink.com. You can also watch these videos individually up at my YouTube channel, Expert Real Estate Tips. If you're new to the show, be sure to subscribe so you get all the podcasts. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please consider giving this show a rating and or a review in iTunes. You can do it by searching for The Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, and this helps the show get discovered by new people. And I would also deeply appreciate it if you get something out of this show to recommend it and forward the link to all of your friends. So that's it for today's episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks for listening, and if you're watching on Expert Real Estate Tips and YouTube, thanks for watching. Have a great week, everybody.